From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Garrison Keillor's first novel has just been published. It's about the early days of radio. On today's Fresh Air, Garrison Keillor reads from his new novel, and we talk about his early days in radio. Also today, the frustrations of city life. Daniel Halpern reads his poem, Leaving the City. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles Mississippi bluesman Skip James. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A day after an upset victory by Democrat Harris Wofford in his Senate race in Pennsylvania, President Bush said that he was depressed over the loss of former U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh to Wofford. While in New Jersey, Governor Jim Florio is trying to survive politically after watching his party suffer a stunning defeat at the polls. Steve Inskeep of member station WBGO has more.
A flood tide of anger with incumbents and with Florio's tax hikes have swept his Democratic Party from control of New Jersey's legislature, given Republicans huge majorities, and given the GOP a counterweight to its defeat in the Pennsylvania Senate race. Democratic support completely collapsed among the same middle-class voters the party is courting nationally. Facing the media today, Governor Florio blamed the national recession.
This recession is hurting people dramatically. And I saw that, and I sensed that people are looking for some help, and they're looking for some hope.
Both sides are calling for cooperation, but the liberal governor now faces a veto-proof legislature hostile to his programs and in a position to cut them back, no matter what he does. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep reporting.
On Capitol Hill, the House has approved a $205 billion appropriations bill that would suspend an administration ban on abortion counseling at federally supported clinics. However, the vote of 272 to 156 was short of the two-thirds needed to override an expected presidential veto. Also in Washington, the government has announced its detailed proposals for making food labels easier to read and to understand. The rules are now open to public comment and will not go into effect until 1993. NPR's Michael Scholer reports that these proposals are an all-out attack on advertising hype.
Health and Human Services Secretary Louis Sullivan has complained that food labels are so confusing, the grocery store has become a Tower of Babel.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the Tower of Babel is coming down.
This morning, Sullivan released rules that would change everything. First, nearly all items in the grocery store would have to have a label. Now, less than two-thirds do. Labels for fresh produce, meat, and fish would be voluntary, but the government threatens to require labels if supermarkets don't volunteer. And labels would be simpler and list key health facts, cholesterol, fat, and saturated fat. Food makers won't be able to fudge the numbers either by claiming minuscule serving sizes. Those would be standardized. Even terms like fresh, low-fat, and light will be controlled. This is Michael Scholer in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 7 points to close at 3,038. This is NPR News. Before leaving this morning for Rome in a two-day NATO meeting, President Bush said that he was ready to work with Congress to find something new to encourage economic growth. Mr. Bush said that election results in Pennsylvania indicated that people are concerned about their livelihood. The president announced late yesterday that he had postponed a trip to Asia later on this year. Mr. Bush has been accused by Democrats of paying too much attention to foreign affairs and not enough attention to domestic concerns. The Prime Minister of the Soviet Ukraine has signed a treaty which would make the Soviet Republic part of the nation's new economic union, but opposition lawmakers warn that Parliament may not ratify this agreement. Tim Huell of the BBC has more.
The Ukrainian Prime Minister, Vitold Fokin, has consistently argued in favor of joining an economic community with other former Soviet republics. But he's had a hard time persuading the parliament in Kiev to share his point of view. in the run-up to presidential elections at which the main issue will be independence. Few Ukrainian leaders want to appear to be surrendering any authority to Moscow-based institutions. Now, however, Mr. Fulkin's won a clear majority in favour of full membership of the Economic Pact, which is now likely to include all the remaining Soviet republics except Georgia. The Ukrainian decision will be a great boost to President Gorbachev and other politicians who've been pressing for continuing close links between the republics.
Tim Huell of the BBC. Democratic Senator Lloyd Bentsen says that his Senate Finance Committee will start work soon on a major tax cut bill, saying it's important to middle-income families to get it started. However, he conceded that there's very little chance of getting it approved this year. Under Bentsen's plan, there would be a $300 tax credit for each child 18 and under and expanded IRA accounts for all workers. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most popular person to emerge from public radio in its short history is Garrison Keillor. He's made an important contribution to American humor with a style that is both down-home and literary. And his fictional Lake Wobegon has become a reference point when Americans talk about a certain kind of small town. I guess it's only fitting that someone who's added so much to radio should devote his first novel to the early days of the medium. Keillor's new novel is called WLT, A Radio Romance. This isn't Keillor's first book. He's had several bestsellers, but they've been books of short stories and a history of Lake Wobegon. As you probably know, Keillor lives in Manhattan now, where he hosts the show The American Radio Company. We invited him to read from his new novel, and after the reading, we'll talk about his experiences writing it.
Back in the spring of 1926 in Minneapolis, two brothers who have a failing sandwich restaurant, Ray and Roy Soderberg, start up a radio station, WLT, which stands for With Lettuce and Tomato, with the idea of promoting their establishment. They come into radio backwards and hire a bunch of friends and people they run into to do the shows who don't know what it's all about either. Even the WLT regulars considered the idea of broadcasting pretty amazing. They could not quite believe it. They never got used to it. To think that their voices were heard by thousands of people all over Minnesota. Leo LaValle would tell his wife Leola in the evening about a joke he told on the radio that day. "You should have heard it," he'd say. "I did hear it as clear as day," she'd tell him. And of course, Leo knew this, and yet never having heard the radio himself, he couldn't be sure. One day, unable to bear the mystery, he backed away from the microphone as he was telling a story about Ole Torvaldsen's horse. Ole got drunk one night and his friends turned the saddle backwards on his faithful horse Henrik, and Ole climbed on board and rode away home to Lena and burst in the door weeping. As he told this joke, Leo edged toward the studio door to the linen closet with the microphone in hand, and he cracked open the studio door just as he came to the punchline, where Ole said, "They cut Henrik's head off, but I stuck my finger in his windpipe and he ran faster than ever," and recognized his own voice on the control room monitor and cried out, "I have heard it." Sensing that the home audience might not grasp the meaning of his remark, he quickly added, "I am on the radio." By June, the broadcast schedule reached 6 hours daily, and by November, they were up to 12, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Mornings were Organ Reflections with Patrice Duval Paulson, The Rise and Shine Show with Buddy and Bob and the Lonesome Ramblers, Dad Benson's Almanac, Elsie and Johnny, Adventures in Homemaking, Current Events with Ray's wife Vesta, who returned in the afternoon with the Poetry Corner, Morning Musicale, Scripture Nuggets with the voice of the Reverend Irving James Knox. "May the good Lord hold you in his loving hands and keep you until we meet again. And remember, keep looking up, friends." The Classroom of the Air, and Let's Sing with the Hamburg Quartet. "It's the one, it's the one, it's the one with the fun in the bun. When you eat a hamburg, you always clamor for just another doggone one." And Today's Good Citizen and Your Health and Hygiene with Dr. Dan Jensen, discussing measles or back pain or blood in the urine, followed by In Memoriam. As we make our earthly journey, let us take some time each day to remember friends and neighbors who have helped along the way. and the Noontime Jubilee with Leo Lavallee and his dreadful jokes, and all of those amateur acts, Miss Stephanie and her all-boy Otto Hart band, and Lance and Marilyn, the Sweethearts of Song, and the Jolly Chums, and Little Catherine under Court of Canaries, and Ray's Uncle Albert reciting Under the Spreading Chestnut Tree, the Village Smithy Stands, and one day they even had a dog named Freckles singing Indian Love Call. And there was Avis Burnett, small town librarian, a show with actors starring Marcia Rowles as the ever-patient Avis, the woman who sacrifices her own happiness in the service of others. Radio leaped the miles and came to every home with a bounty of cheerful information. What a boon, said Roy Soderbergh. Radio was the remedy for isolation, which was the curse of the farmer. Now he had a friendly neighbor to sit down with at any hour of the day and tell him interesting things. Roy set up a farm bureau, and sign-on crept forward to 6 a.m. and then 5 for the farm hour. And he plumped for a late sign-off, but Ray opposed broadcasting at night. And even after he gave in and WLT stayed on the air until 8:30 and then 10 p.m., he was dead set against a Saturday night barn dance show. Saturday night was a family's one night together, and radio shouldn't go barging in and spoil it.
That's Garrison Keillor reading from his new novel, WLT, A Radio Romance. Did the initial idea for the novel, Garrison, encompass this kind of history of radio before the days of TV? Or up until the days of TV, I should say.
Yes, I loved those old radio shows that came before the time that I remember. I grew up in Minnesota listening to the very tail end of that era of radio, when people still wrote scripts and performed them on the air, and when musicians performed in the studio for a radio audience. And what you hear as a child, you never quite lose your fascination with.
What were some of the shows that you remember? Were they anything like the list of shows that you've just read us?
There was a noontime show back in Minneapolis called Good Neighbor Time with Bob DeHaven and Wally Olson and his band, and they had a whole cast of regulars who were on every day and sang, Jeannie Arlen, and they had a cowboy trio, I forget their names, the Red River Valley Boys, I think, and a tenor, and genial Bob DeHaven, who did commercials for Oxydol and interviewed the friends and neighbors who sat in the studio and listened to the show. I listened to it at home, and then I saw it in downtown Minneapolis. I went to the studios to see the show when my mother sent me down to go to swimming lessons at the YMCA. I snuck away from the YMCA because I was afraid of water and went down and watched the radio show. Always terrified that Bob DeHaven would interview me, and then my mother, who was listening at home, would find out.
Did that ever happen?
No, Bob never came close to me. I was just a little kid sitting in the back corner of the studio. But I remember being fascinated by it, the big control room window and men in the dark back there waving their arms and the announcer who had this look of exquisite boredom on his face until the one moment when he's supposed to come up and back announce somebody's song. And then he was all personality for about 15 seconds. And then he sank back into lethargy.
Now, when did you start writing WLT?
This story started out as a story for the New Yorker magazine called WLT, The Edgar Era, which was published, I think, early 70s, 71, 72. And I got interested in that radio station, and I wrote some more stories for the New Yorker about it and one for the Atlantic called The Tip Top Club, and always meant to write a novel about it. Started one. It failed of its own weight because I disliked the narrator so much. I just got tired of him. He's such a bore. He just wouldn't go away. And so I put it aside, wrote Lake Wobegon Days, and then I resumed with the WLT novel about a year and a half ago, and it came rather quickly. Once I threw out most of it, the rest of it quickly spread, and it made a regulation weight novel. Almost a pound, I think. I'm not sure.
401 pages.
How much does that weigh? How much does 401 pages weigh?
Less than Norman Mailer's book, I can tell you that. Were there a requisite number of pages you felt you had to have before you could really call it a bona fide novel?
I felt that it should have a certain heft in the reader's hand, that you shouldn't... if you were to be seen reading a novel in public, you don't want to be... You don't want it to be too thin, or people will think that you're incapable of something more ambitious. So I'm looking out for my reader's self-respect here. This is a decent sized book. People look at you reading it; they'll know you're literate.
What does it mean to you to have finished a novel?
Well, it feels to me as if I've performed a useful service and provided something that. Gives people enjoyment. That was my reason for doing it. I think Lake Wobegon Days was to express myself and to say where I come from, which is another purpose that a writer has, of course, is to defend his or her background and his or her people, and say where you're from and who you are and what makes you different from other people. So I did that in Lake Wobegon Days, which was my other long book. And having done that and served my own purposes, now I've tried to write a book which is amusing. I was not brought up to be an amusing writer, you understand. I was brought up... by serious people with a high moral purpose, and so I'm sort of escaping from it in this book. Its only purpose is to make somebody laugh.
Well, did novels play a part at all in the lives of these serious people with high-minded purpose, anyways?
No, they were church people.
Yeah,
they didn't read novels. Never. We didn't have one novel in our home. I think that's kids. We kids in our family, we had Christian novels. They were novels about like the Sugar Creek Gang series. You probably didn't read that.
No.
These were Christian boys, and they all had wonderful times together. And then there was always...
Having good, clean fun.
That's right, good, clean fun. And then another boy moved into the neighborhood, and he was not saved. And in the course of the novel, he was saved, and he came to church. And every novel was like that.
Did you like these?
Yeah, I sort of liked them, okay. You know. It was all we had.
Right. When did you start going off to the town library and finding other things?
Oh, that was amazing to find other things, including the... things on the high shelves. One of the novelists whom I enjoyed the most early on was Sinclair Lewis, who wrote satirically about the Midwest and about small towns. Main Street and Babbitt were two of my favorite books of his. I liked Lewis a lot when I was a kid because he made fun of the people who... were around me, and I hope that that this book has some of his satiric wit in it.
Garrison Keillor is my guest, and he has a new novel called WLT, A Radio Romance. We'll talk more, but first we'll take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Garrison Keillor's with us. He has a new novel called WLT.
I remember you saying a while back that you really liked to work with a small canvas. That's certainly not what you get to do with a novel. In a novel like this, there's a lot of characters. There's several decades that elapse. What did you enjoy most and find most frustrating about working with that kind of span?
I enjoyed the crowd of characters that that came through here, and I enjoyed naming them. Characters like Leo Lavallee and Luella Wells, who does the Adventures in Homemaking show and gives the recipes for oatmeal cookies and tells how to get cranberry juice stains out of an Angora sweater and the like. I enjoyed creating these characters and naming them and having them parade through, sort of like War and Peace, except they speak English and they're not moody. But the thing that was frustrating is that if all of these characters move through all of these decades in Minneapolis from 1926 through the early 50s, and then the epilogue is in the present time, you have to keep the dates squared away, and the characters have to follow a certain logic. And logic is not my strong suit, nor is consistency. So I've had to pore over this thing and make sure that if he was 12 years old in 1937, then he can't be in his early 40s in 1938, right?
Right. Right.
Okay. That's a problem for some of us who were not good at math.
Do you remember, Garrison, the very first time you were on the air?
Yes, I think that I do. I can remember the first time that I thought that I was on the air. It was a closed-circuit student radio station at the University of Minnesota called WMMR. It was in the student union up on the third floor. And I went in, and I did a newscast. It was at 12 o'clock. It was a 15-minute newscast. I carefully edited this newscast myself and had, as it turned out, about an hour and a half worth of material for it. But I sat down, and I got through 15 minutes of it, and the light went out, and I felt pretty good about it, that I'd sort of gotten the upper Midwest up to speed, you know, on the world around us. And I didn't find out for a long time after that, none of us found out, that we had transmitter problems, and we had no audience. We only imagined that we did. So that was my debut in broadcasting, was working very hard on a 15-minute newscast that I delivered with great conviction to the engineer who was on the other side of the window. I had an audience of one, and I'm not sure I had him for the whole 15 minutes. I think some of his friends came in to the control room during my maiden newscast, and I think that he turned the monitors off. I can't be sure of that.
What was it like for you the very first time you heard your own voice recorded and played back?
You know, I thought it didn't sound that bad, really. I had been listening to newscasters when I was a kid, of course. Cedric Adams was the great newscaster of the Upper Midwest. He used to say that after his 10 o'clock news, Northwest Airline pilots flying over Minnesota could see lights dim in all the small towns all across Minnesota about 10:15. People turn in after they gotten the news from Cedric. But so I worked on his inflection and, you know, that nice sort of friendly and yet authoritative falling inflection, flat Midwestern voice. And I got it down pretty well. But then I got into educational radio, the forerunner of public radio, and they had all those BBC programs on and corrupted my voice for years. I was I was trying to sound British. Ever so often, I think I still hear a twinge of it in my voice.
What were you doing then, reading news or announcing classical music?
I was reading news and announcing classical music, and I was doing documentaries. I wrote some radio plays. I got to do an awful lot, most of which I would not care to listen to again.
Were you able to really pronounce all the classical composers' names?
The ones I absolutely could not pronounce, I didn't play. And so their music has passed into obscurity. A lot of French composers I didn't play as often as the German. The German you kind of fake your way through. Who did I have a hard time with? Millot, I guess. Darius Millot and Jacques Ibert. And I mispronounced them for a while. But once you get it, you know, then you're so proud. You just can't wait for a chance to use Darius Milhaud's name, Eric Satie, and all those guys.
What's the balance now in your life between radio and writing for the page?
Well, radio demands a great deal of attention, 'cause it gets harder the longer you do it, and you keep expecting there to come a time when humor will just run out, and when you'll go on the air and you won't be funny anymore. So I have to keep working at it to keep being silly. And radio writing, I do all the times I can't do radio. I wrote a lot of this book in odd places at odd times, and you have to learn how to do that if you're going to keep two little careers on the burner at the same time.
How's New York been treating you?
New York is treating me the same as it treats everybody else. New York does not make distinctions between people. I get by pretty well here. You just have to remember that in New York, the race is not always to the swift, and you have to be prepared to be sort of continually 15 minutes late for everything.
Have you learned to be loud and pushy yet?
I don't think that I have, but maybe people in Minnesota would think that I have. I'm not sure.
Well, seriously, when you go back to Minnesota, I don't know how often you do that, but when you do you find that your sense of speed or the volume at which you speak has changed?
I get much more irritated if things go wrong, and if the plane is late and the baggage doesn't come, and when you go through all of the sort of ordinary little hassles of life, I think that you get steamed more easily. New York rubs a lot of skin off, I think. It's one of the problems of living here is that it kind of tries your patience.
Thanks a lot for talking with us about your new book and for reading from it and everything. And good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you. Good luck to you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Thanks, and to you.
Garrison Keillor's new novel is WLT, A Radio Romance. Next week, he begins a national tour of readings and book signings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Leaving the City. Daniel Halperin reads a poem about the frustrations of city life, and we talk about his thoughts on getting out. And rock historian Ed Ward says sometimes music lovers do get a second chance to hear a great artist from the past. Now tell us about the reappearance of Mississippi bluesman Skip James. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Newly elected Pennsylvania Senator Harris Wofford came triumphantly to Capitol Hill today, fresh from his upset victory over former Attorney General Dick Thornburgh last night. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Democrat Wofford had been appointed to fill the Senate seat left vacant by the death of Republican Senator John Hines earlier this year. But when Thornburgh left his post as head of the Justice Department to run for the seat, it appeared that Wofford had little chance to overcome what early polls showed as a 40% lead by Thornburgh. Wofford appealed to voters with an issue that is fast becoming a rallying cry for many Democrats, national health care. Looking tired but joyous after last night's victory, Wofford said his election shows that the American people are now ready for action on the health care issue.
Just as that happened in the struggle against segregation laws and in the struggle against Social Security, I know from this great representative state of Pennsylvania that that moment has come on national health insurance.
Standing by Wofford's side, Senate Majority Leader Mitchell said he wants to see action on health care by the end of next year. I'm Andy Bowers at the Capitol.
The Senate will stay in session until it passes an extended unemployment benefits bill. That's the pledge made by Majority Leader George Mitchell today. The Senate is scheduled to break before Thanksgiving. Democrats have been trying to figure out how to pay for extended benefits for jobless Americans. President Bush has twice vetoed an extension, but the president said recently he wants to compromise with the Democrats on a bill. President Bush left for a NATO summit in Italy today, but before leaving announced he would cancel a 2-week tour of the Far East. But as NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports, congressional Democrats are continuing to attack Mr. Bush as a globe-trotting president.
Fueled by the announcement that the president plans to spend more time at home, Democrats stepped up the pressure. Michigan's David Bonnier.
I have a message for the president. Arrivederci. Yesterday's election sent a clear message from the voters. It's time we started to take care of our own.
Democrats used the election results to urge the president to pay more attention to health care and the needs of the unemployed. A new plan to extend unemployment benefits is bound to push the president even further in the corner. Its funding is tied to a freeze in foreign aid, something Bush says he will not do. If he vetoes the bill, Democrats will again be able to charge that the president cares more about foreign problems than the plight of unemployed Americans. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Senate Banking Committee today rejected Robert Clark's nomination for a second term as the Comptroller of the Currency. The Comptroller is the Treasury Department's top banking regulator. The office oversees nationally chartered banks, which hold more than half of the commercial banking industry's assets. The vote against Clark split along party lines. Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 7 points to finish the day at 3038.46. This is NPR News. Human rights groups today urged Secretary of State James Baker to remember human rights concerns on his upcoming visit to China. The group Asia Watch said Baker should also meet with political activists. Baker goes to Beijing next week. He'll be the highest-ranking official to visit China since the Tiananmen Square massacre in June 1989. A letter from a marijuana trafficker was introduced into evidence during the drug trial of Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega today. It casts doubt on Noriega's involvement with the Medellin drug cartel. More from Melissa Mancini in Miami.
The letter, written by an American marijuana smuggler, was sent to General Noriega in 1984. In it, Stephen Kalish outlines events that had transpired in Panama the previous year. The letter suggests Panama's involvement with Colombian drug traffickers was initiated by one of Noriega's subordinates without the general's knowledge. Kalish's letter claims a military officer approached a member of the Medellin cartel about manufacturing cocaine in Panama and also using that country as a distribution center. Kalish backed up the letter in court today, saying he didn't believe Noriega had been involved. The Texan testified Panama had already established itself as a safe haven for money laundering and didn't believe Noriega foolish enough to jeopardize the country's status by inviting the cartel to expand its drug business. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin today banned the Communist Party, nationalized the party's property, and condemned its activities. Yeltsin's decree also cancels tomorrow's traditional November 7th celebrations, marking the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. The federal government today proposed a sweeping package of food labeling changes. Health Secretary Louis Sullivan wants labels to give people more information about what they eat and stop confusing and misleading nutrition claims. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Most people who live in a big city have days when the frustrations of city life are so overwhelming they think about getting out. Daniel Halpern has a poem about that, which I quite like, called Leaving the City. It's published in his new collection, Foreign Neon. Halpern teaches in the graduate writing program at Columbia University. He runs the small press Echo Press and edits the literary magazine Antaeus. So here's Daniel Halpern to introduce his poem.
I spent the first 20 years of my life in Los Angeles and the second 20 in New York, and it seemed to me that now that 40-some-odd years have elapsed, it was time to move elsewhere. And this was my vehicle by which I plan to move. It's called Leaving the City. We were complaining about the streets, how there were none left, whole, and the general disrepair of everything the eye cared to consider. We were complaining about those abandoned to the streets, their mobile homes, and the window washers on the street corners who muddied the clear windows of our cars. And of course, we recognize the pure danger here for what it is and placed it high on our list of complaints. We said we had to leave. We said there was no reason to undergo what daily the city placed before us, on our dish, as it were. The undeniable diminishing returns. Our politics made it impolitic to hate the helpless, the homeless, or the enemies of our well-being. And the mayor refused to engage in meaningful dialogue, thinking only to give over his problems to us, with the single exception of his carefully selected wardrobe. We wondered how we had stayed, if we might have overstayed, and now there was no getting out. We felt the energies pulse through us, the need to respond to the 5 million messages passing through the lines of communication, to the waiting services of private answering equipment. We felt love dissipate in the humidity of the city summer, the longing for real life at a moderate pace. Well, just the greenery of out of town, the casual, easygoing good day. And finally, as the electrical sun weakened on its dimmer, we wept openly for our exhaustion.
Daniel Halpern, you said that you wrote this poem before actually deciding to leave the city?
Well, I've been leaving, in fact, for the last 10 years. It seemed I was always on my way back to California.
So where are you living now?
In New York.
In the city?
Yeah, but we moved this week to Princeton and Hopewell, New Jersey.
Oh, so this is the week you're actually getting out.
This is the week, the very week.
So what are your thoughts this week, actually getting out of the city?
Well, as I said to somebody on the phone today, the weather was so beautiful yesterday, and it's so beautiful in the city today. And I hear it's going to be very fine tomorrow, which covers the past, present, and future. I'm having second thoughts.
I want to ask you about a couple of lines in the poem that I particularly like. The longing for real life at a moderate pace. Is this a goal of yours now?
That's about nature, you see, at a moderate pace. The biggest selling point for me leaving the city was the idea that time outside of New York City is about twice as long. An hour in New York is worth two in the country. And as you get older, those hours begin to add up and count. And I think, you know, at this point at 45 or 46, I want those extra hours.
The last line of the poem, "We wept openly for our exhaustion." Can I ask what you were thinking about in that particular line?
I was thinking about all of the negative things about dealing with New York City, the water mains that break, the traffic, the rudeness, the inherent danger, the fact that in the old days, if somebody irritated you, you could get mad. You could respond with anger. Now, there's so much gratuitous response that you don't know what's going to happen to you. I mean, you pound on the hood of a car because it almost runs you down in an intersection, and you could be faced with two shotguns out of either window. So you're robbed of your kind of basic primitive responses, which are important to me. In Princeton, for example, I can throw rocks at deers who are eating my plants.
So you're still teaching at Columbia, aren't you?
That's right.
So there's a big commute in your future?
You've caught me on a small lie. I'll still be in the city one or two days a week. It's impossible, really, to cut it off completely. You know, you need a small tube running from the country to the city. And my teaching at Columbia is important to me. I don't like the bureaucracy of the academy, but I love my students, and I love talking about poetry with people who are writing it, who are starting out, and it's important for me to keep that connection, both as a teacher, as a poet, and as an editor of a magazine and a press.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Daniel Halper, and he's also the editor of the Echo Press. And we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Daniel Halpern is my guest. He has a new collection just published by Knopf called Foreign Neon. You said before that you lived in Los Angeles for 20 years and in New York for 20 years. What brought you to New York?
Actually, I went from Los Angeles to Tangier. I had met Paul Bowles, and he had suggested coming over there to witness a culture that was, he was convinced, very alien to anything I'd experienced before. So I went there, and I ended up staying. And in Tangier, Paul suggested starting the literary magazine Antaeus. So Tangier represented, in many ways, my kind of graduate work. I was a psychology major in college. And when I went to Tangier, I got involved in reading, really in a sense for the first time, directed by Paul. And when he suggested starting a literary magazine, I'd never seen a literary magazine before. But he felt that we could do it together, and so we started Antaeus there in 1969.
It must have been pretty wild traveling with him to Tangier.
Well, he was in Tangier. He'd lived there for 30 years at that point. And he was in California teaching at a state university at Northridge, in Northridge, California. And when I met him, he was spending, I guess, a semester there, 3 months, and he was on his way back.
You are the editor and publisher of a small literary press, the Echo Press. Your new book of poems is published by, you know, one of the majors, Knopf, which is like the leading literary press in the major publishers. How do you see the responsibilities dividing up nowadays between the major publishing houses and the small houses? Having a foot in each?
That's a long and complicated question. I think that what the small presses are doing in this country is extremely important. They're having a very difficult time. I mean, people are buying fewer books now, and if you see a 10% cut in general book sales, the effect is much greater to a small press than it is to a trade publisher who can rely on the chains to back up that loss. I guess part of your question is, why don't I publish my own poems with a small press?
Gee, that really wasn't my question, but you're welcome to answer it.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
No, I could certainly see why you wouldn't. I mean, let's face it, the larger presses have better distribution, better advertising and promotion.
Do you want to add
to that list?
Yeah, I think that's partially true. I think that the good small presses have taken care of distribution. We, for example, distribute through W.W. Norton, and they do an extremely good job for us. It's true that we don't have large advertising budgets for any of our books, really, but especially for poetry. But then very few trade publishers, if they do publish poetry, have any advertising budget at all. The good thing about books of poetry is they sell in spite of publishing houses. You know, they have their audience, and people find the books eventually.
I want to get back to your upcoming move. What are you doing with your Manhattan apartment? They're in such demand.
I'm keeping that apartment.
So you're subletting?
No, it'll just be there, empty, waiting.
Oh, you are really cheating.
Well, you know, I've got to be in the city to teach.
Right.
And I will use that as a sort of editorial office in the city to meet people and be here when I need to. I mean, since we are in publishing and a lot of writers come through New York and won't be able to get to Princeton, I want to come in and have a chance to meet with them and have a place to go for those meetings.
Daniel Halpern, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Halpern's new collection of poems, Foreign Neon, is published by Knopf. That's Duck Baker from his album, The Art of Fingerstyle Jazz Guitar. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, will you be analyzing the results of yesterday's elections?
We will. We'll be hearing about the ramifications of the results around the country. Also, a report this evening from Patty Naimond, NPR's Patricia Naimond, about health care reform, national health insurance, as a political issue. That was one of the main issues in the Pennsylvania Senate race, and it's one that seems to be catching on around the country with many politicians. Also, a discussion of why the Federal Reserve's lowering of interest rates, which they did once again today, does not seem to be having the immediate effect, the immediate stimulus of the economy that's intended, and about what's in short supply in Moscow, among other things, money.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The music known as Delta Blues actually encompasses a diversity of styles. And although you can chart many performers and their stylistic development, there are also little islands, enigmas which can't and shouldn't be explained. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles one of them, Nehemiah Skip James.
country blues performers were long forgotten when, at the end of the 50s, American folk scholars began rediscovering their records. One thing became clear. Some of the most emotionally affecting music came from Mississippi, made by people we would never experience in person, people who had utterly vanished from the earth. I'd rather be the devil, sang Skip James on his great haunting record, than to be that woman's man, because nothing but the devil changed my baby's mind. This record was one of the great talismans of country blues, one of 26 songs James had recorded in Grafton, Wisconsin for Paramount Records in 1931, just before the company went out of business. The records had barely been distributed, and James, disgusted with having gotten a mere $40 for the session, gave up blues singing and disappeared. It was, everyone agreed, a major loss for American music. Just imagine if he were still alive.
I'll time and drive you from door to door. From door to door, but they can't find no heaven. I don't care where they go.
But Skip James was alive. In 1964, Bill Barth, Henry Vestine, and John Fahey found him in the Tunica County, Mississippi Hospital. And a month later, shaky but happy to know that somebody still remembered him, Skip James sat before an astonished crowd at the Newport Folk Festival and played Hard Time Killing Floor Blues and a bunch of other songs nobody had ever heard before without surface noise. And once he got his health a bit more stabilized, Skip James threw another curveball. During his 33-year retirement, his singing and guitar playing had gotten better.
You'd rather be an old devil. I would rather be the devil than to be that woman, man. You'd rather be the devil than to be that woman, man.
He'd slowed down, but he was past 60. His voice, though, his eerie falsetto, had become one of the most expressive instruments anybody had ever heard. Bit by bit, the story came out about James's disillusionment with the music business, his traveling with a gospel group during the 30s, following his father, a college-educated preacher who eventually became a school administrator in Alabama. After a lifetime spent working in a strip mine outside of Birmingham, he retired in the early 50s to his home in Bentonia, Mississippi, where he farmed until ill health put him in the Tunica County Hospital. He never fully regained his health, and he was always mightily skeptical about contracts, but at least he didn't have to worry about his medical bills any longer. His hit song took care of that.
And I am so glad, yes, I'm glad, until I just don't know what to do. And I am tired of weeping. I'm so tired of mourning. I'm so tired of groaning for you. And I am so, yes, I am mighty glad, until I just don't know what. Would you be my little darling? Would you be my dear? Would you be my darling, be my dear?
Eric Clapton's adaptation of I'm So Glad for Cream made Skip James thousands of dollars. James moved north to Philadelphia and lived anonymously in a black neighborhood, touring when his health allowed. He died there, age 67, in 1969, having re-recorded all of those old Paramount recordings the way he wanted them to sound, and leaving behind an absolutely unique body of Delta blues.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
You want to know who killed Dietrichson? Hold tight to that cheap cigar of yours, Keyes. I killed Dietrichson. Me, Walter Neff. Insurance salesman. 35 years old, unmarried, no visible scars. Until a while ago, that is. Yes, I killed him. I killed him for money. And for a woman. And I didn't get the money, and I didn't get the woman.
Fred McMurray died yesterday at the age of 83. Lots of people who grew up watching him on My Three Sons and in Disney comedies like The Absent-Minded Professor and Son of Flubber were surprised to discover a darker side of him in some of his earlier performances. We remember Fred McMurray today with a scene from his now classic 1944 film noir, Double Indemnity. McMurray played an insurance salesman who falls for Barbara Stanwyck, then falls for her scheme to murder her husband so they can collect the insurance money. This is the scene in which McMurray and Stanwyck meet.
Would you tell me what's engraved on that anklet?
Just my name.
As for instance?
Phyllis.
Phyllis, huh? I think I like that.
But you're not sure.
Well, I'd have to drive it around the block a couple of times.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head in your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it. Eight-thirty tomorrow evening, ma'am.
That's what I suggested.
Will you be here, too?
I guess so. I usually am.
Same chair, same perfume, same anklet.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Fred McMurray died yesterday at the age of 83. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audie Voblaitis, and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with singer-songwriter John Prine. He's just released his first studio album in several years. Also, zoologist Alan Rabinowitz on his adventures in the jungle, trying to save the world's jaguars, leopards, and other large cats. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.